definitely important to acknowledge that we're on stolen land. We're on stolen Aboriginal land, and that for so many thousands of years, Aboriginal people looked after this country and looked after each other, you know, and continue and that fight for land justice and to defend their people and their culture continues. I think it's important in terms of giving some context for this meeting to have an understanding of the approach that we take. We're a socialist organisation, we're Marxists in how we view the world, and we, you know, have a very deep respect for and have a look at the Aboriginal society that existed on this continent for so many thousands of years, as one which I think actually demonstrates that all of the myths that are out there about human nature, that people you know, naturally want to dominate each other, want to have power over other people, want to gain as much wealth as they can possibly gain, that there's a dog-eat-dog mentality that's somehow wired into our DNA. You know, that whole idea about human nature that's out there, I think, is fundamentally disproved when you actually have a look at the society that existed here on this continent for so many thousands of years, and the ideas of reciprocity, collectivity, caring for the land that continue to be alive, you know, in Aboriginal society, regardless of how heavily, you know, the smashing of that society, you know, the attempt has been. The, you know, society that existed here on this continent was one where there were no social classes. There were no masters. There were no chiefs even, you know, it can be debated, you know, different people, but fundamentally egalitarian way of life, no oppression. We'd say, you know, certainly in some cases some quite strict gender roles that people had in terms of, you know, men's and women's, you know, stories and law and those sorts of things, but no oppression in terms of women being subordinate to men, ruled over by men, dominated by men, you know, didn't exist on this continent. No homophobia. You know, no racism. I would actually argue there's, you know, racism is a concept which emerges in history, you know, with capitalism, and which is imposed on this continent along with class divisions, along with oppression, and along with the state. You know, those systems actually come in 1788 when the ships land in 1788, and you get the birth of oppression and domination and everything that goes along with it on this continent when the British military dictatorship turned up. So, you know, for us as Marxists, we have an understanding and an analysis of the system that we live in today. It's a capitalist society, you know, and we say that the state and the form of government that we have in this society, you know, is one which serves the interests of the capitalist class. The reason why you have the police force, the army, this whole apparatus of state power exists to protect a system where the huge majority of the world's resources and wealth is concentrated and controlled in such a tiny, tiny number of hands. An elite, a capitalist class who do one thing with that wealth, and that's try and reproduce it and make even more. The system requires them to maintain, you know, profits, to get more and more and more profit, to expand their profit, and doesn't matter if that means that the world's going to be, you know, driven into climate catastrophe. Doesn't matter if that means that this is horrific, you know, poverty, you know, and everything that we see out there, you know, that they will fight to maintain their class power and their class position. So the state for us is a class state. It's something that's owned and controlled by the capitalist class. You know, and Marx, you know, has a theory about, you know, the exploitation of the working class under capitalism, the wealth that's produced by the working class, you know, being what actually feeds capitalist profits, and the need to actually overthrow the state if working class people everywhere are going to be liberated and are going to have control over their lives. But we fundamentally would say the Australian state has that quality as well, the system of government that we have here in Australia. But it also has another very, very important characteristic when you're talking about the context of Australia and the context of the settler colonial system that was imposed here in Australia. And that is that the state exists not just to control the working class and exploit the working class, but the state has emerged historically as a tool to dispossess Aboriginal people and ensure that they are dispossessed, that they remain dispossessed, that they remain in a marginal position in the society, and their rightful claims to the land that was stolen from them, you know, are not realised. The state exists to enforce one social order, one system, the capitalist system here in Australia, on top of a really existing society that was there before. And that contradiction and that tension is something that is absolutely fundamental. It's a living, you know, part of and continues to be a living part of Australian politics and the Australian political system. That tension that's built into the settler capitalist regime, as I'd characterise it here in Australia. And here in this talk here today, in the time that I've got left, I'm going to just give a few examples of how that tension and how that contradiction has played out at different times in Australian history, depending on the particular needs of the economy and depending on the particular needs of the capitalist class in Australia at that particular time in history, I would argue, is what has fundamentally shaped the changing nature, though constant nature, of Aboriginal oppression through Australian history. So the Australian ruling class has, from day one, when they first set up here in 1788, they have had what is known in the literature, in the government debates and everything else, as the Aboriginal problem. They've had a problem. As I said, the land was stolen. The whole society was established on top of, you know, a whole other really, really existing society. And this problem is posed in three ways, I think, you know, three fundamental ways. The first one is a problem of control of territory, control of land. They need to be able to actually control the land that Aboriginal people have a claim to and Aboriginal people fight for and continue to fight for. They need to be able to control that land, and so it can be smoothly integrated into the economic system. So it can be used by, you know, whether it's the farmers or the mines or the real estate agents or whoever it is, used by business without fetters and without interruption, used as a commodity without worrying about any, you know, pesky questions of Aboriginal need and Aboriginal ownership. So one of the fundamental problems is the struggle over territory and control of territory. Another fundamental problem is the ideological challenge that's actually posed by the question of Aboriginal land ownership. And it's an ideological problem which speaks to the very legitimacy, actually, of the Australian state and of its claims to the land here in this country. On what basis, actually, is that mine belonging to Gina Rinehart? Why is it that she owns it and not the people who lived there for thousands and thousands of years? On what basis is the decisions that are taken here in this city, you know, about, you know, where land's going to go, where people are going to go, etc., when this whole system was imported and imposed on top of other people? So there's an ideological quandary that they have, you know, that actually the whole thing's a fiction. The whole legal system, everything they built is a fiction on top of, you know, on top of another society. So, you know, to solve this ideological problem, I would argue that is where the actual idea of anti-Aboriginal racism comes from. These people have no rights. These people have no claim to land. These people have no, you know, thing, because they're inferior, actually. They're not really human. That, you know, our society is superior. We had, we have productivity. We developed the economy, these sorts of things. That's what matters. We're actually superior to you. You're inhuman. We can exterminate you. We can take your land. We can think that the racist ideas that are foundational are actually developed and deployed in order to justify and bolster and provide an ideological justification for the legitimacy of the Australian state. And it's the third problem in that sense that I'd say that's posed is the continued existence of Aboriginal people actually as a people, as in the eyes of the capitalist system and in the eyes of the government, this is a surplus people that they actually don't know what to do with. They've thoroughly dispossessed people and smashed their traditional way of life. What do you say then about the people that continue to live, to breathe, to claim the land, to point the finger about the historical crimes that have actually been caught, you know, that have actually been caused by the government? So in that sense, the dispossession, the historical dispossession that is, you know, at the centre of Australian society is posed every single day by the living existence of Aboriginal people. You know, and it's posed sometimes in a more political way in terms of protest, in terms of people being organised to put demands, but sometimes it's posed just in, you know, Just in day-to-day life. Like, I've just, you know, example, you know, come back from Alice Springs, living there last year. I mean, every single morning, council rangers have to wake up and there's actually homeless Aboriginal people that are camped, you know, all over the town. You know, what do we do with these people? So they hurriedly go around and try and shoo them away. You know, there's people queuing up to get into the hospital emergency room because of the, you know, the poverty people are forced into, the, you know, squalid living conditions, etc. You know, create, you know, it's the living reality of dispossession is posed in the hospital emergency room every single night. What's the government going to do about this? What are they going to do about all these problems that have been created by dispossession? So that's the other problem that they have, is this, you know, really living, existing, you know, sort of reminder. And I just, like, there was a quote, there was South African activist that was out here recently and commented on the situation that Aboriginal people are facing. I thought it was actually quite a profound quote, talking about the racism in Australia. I think it's a woman, I'm not sure. Sisonke Simang is how I'd say you'd pronounce the name. The quote was, "It's as though on some psychic level, white Australians are angry with Aboriginal people for still being here, for reminding them of their sins, for refusing to conform to their own ideas about what Australia is or should be." You know, I think it's a very profound quote, but, you know, in terms of understanding, these ideas are there out there. They are out there in white Australia. They are held by so many people walking around with this, you know, incredulous, "You still here? What are you still doing here?" you know, sort of attitude that is to Aboriginal people. But the ideology, you know, I'd actually argue, isn't in the interests of the vast majority of the people that are walking around with those ideas in their heads. That ideology is in the interests of the rulers who actually, you know, that tiny minority in Australian society that really do actually control and own the land, you know, but it's an ideology that they fight for and that they campaign for, you know, out there in society. So what are they going to do about the Aboriginal problem? What is the ruling class going to actually do about it? Well, I'd just like to say a few things about what they're not going to do, about what they can't do if they want to be able to actually maintain the integrity of their system. The first thing they can't do is actually have any substantive return of the land to the Aboriginal people, because it's now thoroughly integrated into big business. So actually giving people land back in a serious way is off the table. I mean, you have a look at New South Wales. You know, there's 0.1% of New South Wales has been returned to Aboriginal people under the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Rights Act. It might even be less. You know, you could put a little claim in over a little piece of Crown land that we don't have any use for. Maybe you can claim that land. In the Northern Territory, they have substantive land rights over quite big areas of the Northern Territory that just happen to essentially be mostly desert, you know, that don't have a use in that sense for the colonial economy. And as soon as it does have a use and they find some minerals under that desert and they do want to do something with it, they'll turn around and do something quick smart about the land rights. You know, look at the native title system. You know, people might claim back some native title, but native title gives you no veto over any economic activity that actually takes place on your land. You know, you might be given native title. "I've got a right to walk on here and hunt, or walk on here and camp," but if they want to build a mine there or they want to start, you know, some enterprise, you have no veto, you can't say no. So off the table is substantive return of land from the perspective of the capitalist class in this country. Also off the table is the actual funding of and provision of resources into the hands of Aboriginal people in a way that would allow them to develop an organisation and a confidence that would allow them to challenge their structural position and challenge, you know, the situation that they are in. You know, so we do a lot of work around a lot of social issues that are out there in the Aboriginal community. Myself, I do a lot of campaigning with families that have had their children taken away from them by their child welfare services. This is happening en masse. There are thousands of Aboriginal kids that are getting taken away from families every single year. You know, today, the excuses that are given are often there's neglect going on in the household. You know, the poverty conditions that people are in is what essentially leads to these children, you know, sort of being taken away. Often there are serious issues. The family does need support. They do need better housing. They do need employment opportunities. They do need some help, you know, but actually turning around and saying we are going to fund local Aboriginal organisations with the resources that would be needed to deal with the issues that we see in the families on their own terms, off the table. Why is it off the table? Because that would mean that they're too confident. That would mean that they're too organised. That would mean that they could actually play a role in organising the demonstrations that we've seen about the closures in Western Australia or land rights or anything like that. So they can't deal with the social problems because they can't give the resources to the people at the grassroots level that could actually do the business in terms of turning those things around, because they're too scared. They're too scared of a confident, well-organised Aboriginal population and what it might do in terms of challenging the legitimacy of the Australian ruling class. So that's off the table. right? So we can't have that, you know. And the other thing that you can't do is you can't actually put forward any narrative of Australian history or narrative of Australian present which undermines the legitimacy of the system, which says, yes, this is fundamentally based on violence and genocide. The system itself is actually based, you can't tell the truth about the history, because telling the truth about the history would open up all sorts of, political, horizons and avenues for what would be needed in terms of bringing some real justice, to the people. So all those things are off the table. Anything that would actually sort of assist Aboriginal people to deal with the situation they find themselves in is inconceivable from the conditions of in terms of the people that rule Australia. So consistently throughout history, if you look at what has been done throughout history in terms of dealing with the Aboriginal problem, it's essentially two tactics. The first one, or strategies. The first one is the use of violent force, to actually go in and solve the questions about, land use and territorial control and those sorts of things by essentially, in terms of the frontier war days, killing anyone who gets in your way of setting up a farm. We'll just wipe you out. We'll just gun you down. So the actual use of armed force, genocidal force, to clear the land, absolutely central in terms of a strategy that's come from the rulers. And even if it's not, using the armed force in that sort of extreme way that we saw in the frontier wars, today it would certainly be going into communities in Western Australia and saying, we've turned off the power and water. There is no education system that's operating here. If you want to keep your kids and they're not going to be taken by the Child Protection Agency, you better get them to school that's going on in the town. And there's a few police in the car that are there to tell you that your community's been closed down. It's time everyone moves along now. So that use of the force is absolutely still, a central component of dealing with the Aboriginal problem as the ruling class sees it. But the other strategy, that they've used from day one is the strategy of assimilation. Is a strategy of actually saying we will try and mould the Aboriginal population and force and use discipline, but also carrots and the carrot and stick to try and mould people to accept the legitimacy of the Australian state, accept the legitimacy of what's happened to you historically. Assimilate, be like us. We're superior. Change your belief systems, change your ways, join the colonial society. That's been the other, historically that this has been used. And I'm not going to have time to do the history thing. But I'd give it, I had a few examples from history. I'll just give a few quick ones of this example, I think, of the way these two things really, really go together in history: the use of the force to solve the problems, and then the use of this attempt at assimilation. The first was actually in the year 1789, just after they landed here in Sydney Cove. It was the first year of the invasion. Black resistance in Sydney essentially meant that the new the couple of thousand people that had come off the boats were essentially stuck in Sydney Cove. They couldn't establish the farms they wanted established out in Parramatta. They couldn't get out to the more fertile areas because people were fighting them and would fight them back. And so to try and deal with this problem, they did two things. Firstly, increasingly sending out punitive parties, to actually go out and kill large numbers of Aboriginal people, including sending, one in 1789, there was a punitive raid where people went down the track, just King Street there used to be an Aboriginal path down to Botany Bay. They sent the military down there with the explicit instructions. They had hatchets and they had head bags to go out and bring back six heads, cut off six heads and bring them back, as a trophy to try and show that they were fighting the resistance. At the same time as that they were doing that, they'd also actually captured a few Aboriginal people. The first one they'd captured was a man named Arabanu, and the Watkin Tench, who was a military man who was on the boat at the time. So the purpose of this capture was to try and convince these people of the superiority that we possess. So he was put on a long leash, he was given alcohol, plied with alcohol, he had his beard cut, he was dressed in English clothes, he was quickly picked up some English, and this was going to be the man that was going to accept our way of life and convince all of his savage friends that they too should accept the colonial society. Didn't go so well. Yeah, poor old Arabanu, it's a bit of a horrible story if you want to actually have a look at it. Moving along in colonial history, Lachlan Macquarie, so many things named after him, Macquarie Bank, Macquarie Street, all this, Lachlan Macquarie, who was the governor of New South Wales in the early 19th century, took power at a time when capitalism in Australia was really starting. It wasn't just going to be a penal settlement anymore where we send out a few convicts. We're going to try and take land, put sheep on it, farm it, make money, get enterprising individuals out here to sort of build an economy in the colony. This was Macquarie's vision, you know, as the governor. So in 1816, he gives some orders to his punitive party to go out, and on any occasion of seeing or falling in with the natives, he orders them, either in bodies or singly, they are to be called on by your friendly native guides to surrender to you as prisoners of war. So they had managed to get a few people to work from them. If they refuse to do so or make the least show of resistance or attempt to run away from you, you will fire upon them and compel them to surrender. Such natives as happen to be killed on such occasions, if grown up men, are to be hanged up on the trees in conspicuous situations to strike survivors with the greater terror. You know, so kill the men, string them up on the trees, strike terror into everyone's hearts, and then... But his other orders, he wanted as many women and children as possible to be captured and delivered as native prisoners of war to Windsor and Parramatta. All the captives were to be handcuffed or tied two and two together with ropes. And from amongst their numbers, 18 fine, healthy, good-looking children, 12 boys and 6 girls, aged between 4 and 6, were to be sent to the native institution at Parramatta. So yeah, on the one hand, go out, kill the men, hang them on the trees, take the children, put them in the institution, teach them to be like us, teach them to accept our society. You know, so those things that, absolutely go together, absolutely, sort of go hand in hand. Jumping forward, just before I finish, for one other example, to the 1920s. At this time, the question of military control of the continent has, in that sense, been settled by the 1920s. The frontier wars, if you like, are in some ways over. I mean, massacres continue. 1928, you still have the Coniston Massacre in 1928, more than 100 Walpri and Kadich, Mudjeta people killed on a cattle station, shot down, in the Northern Territory. But, here in New South Wales, the main Aboriginal problem that they have is what to do with this surplus population. And the strategy at the time, at that time, was essentially put people in a holding pen sort of situation. Set up these reserves. People have got denied rights. You know, they can't leave the reserve without permission from the manager. They can't get paid, whether it's just in rations, that's all people are entitled to. You know, so people are living in these sort of essentially like prisoner of war camps, really, if you want to look at it, sort of all over the state, of New South Wales. But the new strategy that they bring in at this time is a systematic campaign of assimilation. They say, we're going to shut down the reserves, we're going to force all the working age people actually to go out and work in the society, and we're going to take the children away, put them into families, put them into foster homes, etc., and they will assimilate. And why do we need to do this? The Protection Board at this stage said that Aboriginal people were an increasing danger because although there are only a few full-blooded Aborigines left, there are 6,000 of the mixed bloods growing up. It is a danger to us to have people like that amongst us looking upon our institutions with eyes different from our own. So these people are some sort of existential threat. They have eyes that look on our institutions, assimilate them forcibly, force them to assimilate. In the course of a few years, there will be no need for the camps and stations. The old people have passed away and their progeny will be absorbed into the industrial classes of the country, is what the Protection Board said at the time. And I think that's an important point, I suppose, just to finish on so we've got some more time for discussion. It's not just we're going to get people and make them like white people, as though there's some, homogenous group of white people. They're going to be part of the industrial classes of the country. The boys are going to be labourers. The girls are going to be working as servants in the thing. There's no question these people are going to go on to be businessmen or lawyers or anything like that. There's a class system that they have, a very, very vicious class system, and Aboriginal people are going to slot in at the lowest level to be exploited, etc., in that sort of a situation. And the interesting thing about what happens in the 1920s is when the needs of capitalism change, the actual approach to Aboriginal people changes. So the Depression hits in the late 1920s. 28, 29, the economy goes into crisis, tens of thousands of people become unemployed, huge numbers of those are Aboriginal people that have only just entered the workforce, and suddenly you have all these unemployed workers' camps all over the place, many of them full of Aboriginal people, and then that's seen as a threat. That's seen as like this thing, so they actually, what they do in the 1930s, is they go back to the reserves. They pass legislation which says that, most of the, people who weren't going to be considered Aboriginal before, now only a drop of blood, Aboriginal blood, as they said at the time, is enough to make you Aboriginal. And they round people up and put them back on the reserves again, you know, because there's this surplus population that they can't actually get into the workforce, you know, or whatever. And I think that, you know, it's in this period that you get some of the most intense Aboriginal activism that comes in the 1930s, when you have people, Aboriginal people, that had been out working, had experience in trade unions, had some confidence in terms of the broader society, now being put back under this oppressive welfare board regime, and they start to actually fight it and they start to organise, and there's strikes on the reserves. On the day of mourning, which is in 1938, there was a big, you know, meeting here in Sydney when the Colonial Society was celebrating 150 years of Australian settlement. The Aboriginal people had a protest, a day of mourning, led by Aboriginal people who, most of them had been trade unionists. They'd now been organised in the Australian, in the Aborigines Progressive Association, to say 150 years on from the invasion, we remember this as a crime. We remember what you've done to us. We don't accept the legitimacy of your authority. We want our rights in this country. We want our land back. We want our children back, you know, and started to organise, you know, and started to fight. So I might just actually leave it there, I think, you know, in terms of for opening up, you know, to broader discussion rather than going through too much more history. But I did want to say these dynamics, you know, I've given a few different examples of how these strategies have changed. This is absolutely 100% alive today. Any initiative that the government is taking in Aboriginal affairs, it is always directed at trying to solve these problems that we sort of discussed at the start, but solve them on the terms of capitalism, solve them on the terms which says the wealth that's held in such few hands is never going to be challenged. You know, the legitimacy, you know, of our ideology in terms of a competitive system where people are pitted against each other, that's never going to be challenged. And, you know, in terms of the working class in Australia, we look to as Marxists as a force which can actually transform that productive system. You know, we're brought together in our workplaces, we can organise to take those resources for the majority, to, you know, implement a socialist system where, you know, it's an economy that serves everyone. Doing that and breaking through and actually getting the radicalism and the politics to do that means that we have to be enemies of anti-Aboriginal racism. We have to smash the ideas about racial inferiority. We have to smash the ideas about the need for people to forcibly assimilate. We have to say all of Australia is Aboriginal land and always, always will be. And that, you know, that revolution here in Australia, an anti-capitalist revolution, is going to have a very strong, you know, quality in terms of Aboriginal liberation and justice for, you know, for the people who are the real owners of this continent. Thank you.